what's happening to refugees does actually affect everybody because it signals the kind of society that we're living in. Are we able to take care of people that are vulnerable and oppressed and find themselves in a difficult situation? Or are we not? And it's almost like an indicator of where we're headed. It's very frightening.
This is Mission to Scale, a podcast that reveals the tools, mindsets, and strategies that organizations and funders need to maximize their impact. Because the world's biggest problems need solutions at scale. I'm your host, Dan Borelowitz, founder of Spring Impact. At the end of 2021, 89.3 million people worldwide were forced to flee their homes, the most since World War II. As we face the threat of climate change and ongoing conflicts, the numbers are only expected to increase. These refugees, many of whom are children, are at risk of experiencing long-lasting trauma. Today's guest is Zalasht Halamzai, founder and CEO of AMNA, formerly known as the Refugee Trauma Initiative. AMNA started in Greece in 2016 when the country saw an unprecedented number of refugees, mainly fleeing from the war in Syria. AMNA is now training local organizations around the world to offer trauma care. In this episode, Zalasht tells her personal story of displacement and takes us back to the beginnings of AMNA. We also talk about the challenges she experienced as the founder of an organization that is rapidly growing whilst addressing one of the greatest humanitarian crises. Zalasht is originally from Afghanistan.
My life started very ordinarily, like most people around the world. My parents come from pretty ordinary families in Afghanistan, and they have a pretty beautiful love story. They met when my mom was quite a senior person in a school. My dad got a job as an administrator in her team, and they fell in love and got married. And, you know, my dad to this day says that your mom was the boss and she'll always be that way. So, you know, it's very ordinary family, but in a quite an extraordinary place and an extraordinary time. And that where we were, Kabul, Afghanistan, was wedged between two empires, you know, the US and the USSR, and the country was the battleground for who was going to come on top, and we were caught in the middle of that. So my childhood oscillated between very normal, ordinary things like, you know, family events and stories and grandparents, and then the war that was going on, you know, bombs and people dying and being afraid for our lives and what would happen. And that insecurity forced my parents to leave our home. And we genuinely didn't know where we were going to end up. And that's the case for most people that are forced to leave their home in that, in those kind of circumstances. What we wanted to do was to get away from what was going on at the time, which was in, you know, very extreme violence and on the streets of Kabul. And so we left, and we left our extended family behind, my grandmother. And after 4 years of traveling and trying to figure out where we would end up, my parents realized that we actually couldn't go back home because the Taliban had taken over. It was 1996. And both my parents were really passionate that we should all get an education and get the most opportunity that we can to live a normal life. So we came to the UK. And by the time we got here, I was 15 years old.
So you'd spent 4 years sort of in this period without a state, without knowing where you were going to go. Can you tell us a bit more about what that's like? I mean, I guess it's so familiar to almost everyone in the world to have a country that you belong to, a place that you can go back to. What's the feeling like to not know where you're going?
you feel like you're suspended in space almost, that there is nothing to tether you to anything. I think people who are born and grow up and live in places where there are institutions, where there's a rule of law, where there's a state that, you know, issues you a passport, it's really difficult to imagine or understand what it's like to not have any of those things. In reality, they provide a great deal of practical material, but also emotional security, knowing that you can appeal to an institution for, you know, for care, for your rights, to be able to travel, you know, to be able to have a passport that allows you to cross borders. All of that for us was gone in the time that, you know, we were stranded essentially between Kabul and London, and we couldn't register for basic services. If something happened to us, we couldn't go to the police. You know, there's all these different practical implications of not having a state. And then there is the sort of the identity part of it, which is, you know, as a young person, I really genuinely had no idea where I belonged, where I could go for help, and not knowing that part of it made my future pretty remote and vague. You know, I wasn't really sure where I was going to end up. And this situation that I'm describing is pretty typical of many, many asylum seekers and refugees around the world. It takes a really long time to get to a place where you actually hold a passport or a citizenship in your hands. I think the average time is around 15 years where people spend in limbo or waiting for their asylum application to be processed. You know, there's all of that, but then there is the psychological pressure of just being in a limbo for years and years and years and not knowing what's going to happen to you, that builds a great deal of emotional pressure in individuals and families and in communities.
So you arrived in the UK and sought asylum, but you've said that the first 2 years in the UK was the hardest that you and your family faced. Could you share a little bit about what some of those challenges were?
You know, I was a teenager, and, you know, it's such a formative time. It's a time when you want to be accepted, and, you know, you want to have friends, and you want to have all the things that all the other teenagers have. And my family wasn't in a position to do any of that stuff for me. The first day I went into an English classroom, I had no idea what anybody was saying because I didn't speak a word of English. So it was, you know, as a 15-year-old walking into high school, it was just very intense, you know, and it was really tough, and I was depressed. And I remember sort of just sitting in the back of the class and thinking, you know, just how did this happen, and why are we here, and why is this happening to us? And, you know, I couldn't really come up with that many answers. For many people that read about refugees or try and understand, you kind of think that once you get to the place where you are safe and you're given a certain amount of security, that a lot of what you're running away from will disappear and you can settle into something happier. And reality is not that, you know, that's not the case, because first of all, you arrive in a country and you have to start from scratch, you know, completely from scratch. You have to learn the language. You have to become socially literate in a culture that is not your own. You have to understand all of the bureaucracy to be able to access all the things that you need. To get refugee status is an incredibly difficult, long process. So many refugees have to recount incredibly traumatic experiences over and over and over again to prove that their life was in danger and that they, you know, they need the safety. And, you know, so there's huge, huge myriad of challenges, practical challenges. And there is, you know, other experiences that kind of put psychological pressure on people, and that when you arrive in safety, it's almost the first place where you can begin to grieve and feel, you know, and remember everything that's happened to you. You know, up until we came to the UK, we were running, essentially. We really didn't have the space or the time to reflect on what had happened. And begin to count the losses that we'd experience. So the UK was the first place that we could do that. So that was a really difficult thing for us. And then, you know, all the kind of trauma that you experience because, you know, you're poor, you're a refugee, there are prejudices, there's racism, there's all these different things that you're interacting in this new country. All of those things are difficult and traumatic. And my story by no means is a unique one. I think most refugees that come to the UK experience some form of this. And we, you know, as communities, as a country, we haven't yet figured out how to create a mechanism for people to integrate without experiencing a great deal of distress, basically.
Zalasht's personal experience inspired her to begin her career in the education sector. She focused on trauma care for children.
I was working with the education team at Save the Children, and we had an office set up on the Syrian-Turkish border in a town called Antakya. And the work that the team that I was in was doing, it was about keeping the Syrian children learning both as refugees, but also in northern Syria, where many of the NGOs that were set up in Antakya at the time were working. They were working in Idlib and Aleppo and all these different, you know, Syrian cities. That experience really made me want to do what I'm doing now, which was witnessing the overwhelming violence that was going on in Syria and seeing what the families that we were working with were going through with very little support to help them cope with what had happened. You know, I mean, you know, the time that I was there was between 2014, 2015, and it was a horrific time. There was barrel bombs every day, chemical attacks, all these different things were happening. Many, many schools were bombed and hospitals, all, you know, just unimaginable horrific violence. And we weren't really providing trauma care. We weren't really providing the kind of care that you imagine anybody needing if they'd just run for their lives and lost people along the way. So all these different things over the 15 years that I was working just cemented this idea that having a vehicle or lots of vehicles really to help provide trauma care as like a social support was incredibly important in recovery, whether it's from a war or a disaster or, you know, structural inequality. All these things create intergenerational trauma, and we need to be able to deal with it. We need to be able to address it if we're going to break a cycle of violence and all these different things.
After spending time working abroad, Zalasht returned to the UK, hoping to take a sabbatical.
And instead, I ended up setting up an organization. I was wanting to do something about the trauma and psychosocial part of what was going on in the refugee crisis. And a friend of mine put me in touch with a mutual friend of ours, David Altula, who was also thinking about setting up something that would provide trauma care. I'm a doer and David's a doer. And so when we were working together, there was this incredible synergy that we would just say, let's do this. And it would happen, you know. And I think we both take risks in a way that we just kind of go for it and think, let's just try it. If we fail, that's okay. I think that was one of the things I really liked about working with David. He seemed comfortable with failing if something didn't work. And I think that's a really important part of solving problems is trying different things. And if something doesn't work, being quite honest about it and saying, well, this didn't work, let's try something else. I think that's really important and can often be forgotten, particularly in large organizations. I think there's a sort of an inhibition to, you know, everything has to work, and that just doesn't correspond to reality. So we decided that we'd go to Greece and set up a space. I went to Lesbos and then to northern Greece and Thessaloniki in Idomeni, which was this huge camp that was created overnight. And we set up a tent that invited people to come in and talk if they felt like this is what they wanted to do. And to my astonishment, our tent was full every single day from the minute we arrived in the camp, which was usually before 9 a.m. to the minute that we left, it was women, children, men would come in and they wanted to talk. They wanted to tell their story. They wanted to have someone listen to what had happened to them. And it felt at the time that that witnessing that we were able to provide in a way gave them a bit of relief and respite to, you know, from what was happening to them.
Hey, Mission to Scale listeners, I need a favor. If the show has helped you in any way, can you share this episode with a friend or colleague? Maybe it's someone who likes listening to good podcasts in their downtime or on their way to work. All you have to do is copy the link in this episode and send it over with a, hey, you might want to check out Mission to Scale. To keep providing the show, we need to build our audience. And if you haven't yet, please subscribe where you listen to your podcasts. Appreciate you for helping spread the word. And thank you for being part of the Mission to Scale community. Now back to the show. What sort of challenges were they bringing? Was it really just talking through their stories, or what other support were they looking for?
They were facing so many challenges. You know, this was a makeshift camp. There wasn't anything formal that was being provided to them. I think at the time, even the UN didn't even have that. It had a very small presence. Most of the care was provided by volunteers, which was pretty chaotic and difficult. So they had so many things that they needed, and the border had been shut overnight. Everyone that we were working with was hoping to make their way to Europe, and then the EU-Turkey deal happened and all of that came to a halt. But again, in our group, people talked about what had happened to them, what made them leave, how they were feeling, you know, all the kind of, we heard women, you know, talk about the concern over their, you know, children's future. You know, most of the parents that we talked to were worried that they made a mistake because, you know, what they wanted to do was to bring their kids into something that was safer and stable and predictable. Instead, they were in this camp and they felt really guilty about that. You know, they were wondering whether this was the right thing for them. You know, we had so many people express, you know, incredible sadness and grief and sometimes shame that they couldn't provide for their family, that they had to go and stand in a queue for 3 hours to get a plate of food, you know, that you had to basically to bathe. There was a makeshift bath that was constructed in the camp and you had to get an appointment. And it was, of course, massively overbooked because there were 15,000 people. And there was a lot of shame and guilt and humiliation and all these things that were coming out because people were being subjected to incredibly inhumane, disrespectful circumstances. And so that's all we heard. I thought if I was in that situation, my family never had to live in a camp, which, you know, I'm very grateful for given how difficult camps are, right? And I thought if I was in that situation, I'd probably come in and say, can you help me with, you know, X, Y, Z, you know, can you get me clothes? Can you get me this? But we actually had that happen very rarely. Most people, when they understood what the space was for, they just wanted to talk.
The improvised tent set up in 2016 evolved to become AMNA, which means safe and caring in Arabic. AMNA specializes in supporting the psychosocial well-being of refugees and other displaced communities. Among other projects, they run an early childhood program, as well as one for young people transitioning into adulthood. Their work is crucial given our current context, but Zalash knows that AMNA is only treating the symptoms of a really complex global issue.
The reason that the people that we support are fleeing is mostly conflict, and our intention is to work with climate refugees, so those two big issues, global issues, chronic conflicts, and climate change need a political solution. We cannot address that. What we're dealing with are the symptoms or the consequences of those problems. That's what we're doing. But the solution has to come from politicians, but also the global institutions around the world. You know, it has to be something that is global. I think when people think about the war in Ukraine or Syria or Afghanistan, you sort of think, you know, Syria is essentially was covered as a sort of a civil war until Russia physically occupied Syria, right? But all of these wars involve multiple stakeholders. You know, for example, in Ukraine, over 40 countries are involved now in supporting Ukraine against Russia. And in Afghanistan, obviously, NATO was involved, the US, the UK, pretty much every country at one point that has an army was involved in Afghanistan at some point. So these are very global issues and problems that need that sort of a solution. What makes me really concerned is that we don't really have a mechanism for de-escalating violence when it happens because we don't have those global structures that are able to do that. But putting that aside, we just did a 5-year strategy, and based on our research and, you know, everything that we're looking at, all the trends, the number of refugees is going to keep going up. There are multiple conflicts around the world and there's no solution inside, and they're probably going to be more conflicts in the next 10, 15 years. And then climate change is going to drive people out of their homes. So the number of refugees are going up and the need for these kind of services is going to go up. And I, of course, this is the thing that I'm really passionate about, but I really believe that without addressing the trauma part of it, you can't address some of the solutions. So for example, in order to make sure that peace building happens, you need to address trauma, because without the capacity to, you know, address grievances in a, you know, in a non-violent way, you can't really make peace in places where there's chronic conflict. So for us, looking ahead, we know that we're going to have to do more of this, not less.
For Zalesh, we can only address this great challenge through collaboration. That's why AMNA created models for trauma care that can be replicated and adapted into a variety of contexts.
The problem of refugees and the increase in refugee numbers is something that not a single organization can address by themselves. It's not, even the UN, UNHCR can't do that, Save the Children can't do that. So the only way that I think we can address these issues is by building coalitions and working as a network. And so AMNA's strategy for the next 5 years is to select organizations, community organizations that are already working with refugees in different countries that need the financial and the technical support to run trauma-informed care and provide that. And at the same time, as we're building their capacity to be able to offer these services, is to connect them with other organizations that are doing this. So we've done that in Greece. We run a 3-year pilot program in recruiting and training Greek organizations to run our early childhood program and providing a financial incentive for them to do that. When the Afghanistan crisis happened, we launched a call to invite organizations that are working with Afghan refugees in Albania and Kosovo, all around the Balkans. And then we did the same thing in Ukraine. And it's been amazing to see not only how much we can do by working with community organizations, they're able to take our dollar and stretch it so much more than, you know, let's say a huge international NGO. And at the same time, by putting them in cohorts and connecting them with each other, there's space for them to solve problems together, to reflect together, to have a network that they could reach out to when something's going wrong. Like, so for example, you know, there are practical things about access to certain refugees in urban settings. And we had organizations working together to figure that out and their contacts. So that's what we're doing. Instead of AMNA growing, you know, as a huge service delivery organizations, we're building a healing network, a network of community organizations around the world that can offer this to refugees. So it's something that we're implementing right now, and we have a very ambitious plan to take this to every region in the world and obviously take the time to make sure that what we're doing is appropriate for the context and the cultures of the people that we're working with. And, you know, it's sensitive and it's not imposing anything. But one thing that I have a lot of faith in is, you know, is this reciprocal nature of building coalitions and building a network. What we bring is part of the story. The organizations themselves have great deal of expertise. They understand the context. They've been working in their area for a long time. And so they also bring 50% of the equation. And it's in that coming together and working as a coalition that I think we can make the most difference.
I asked Zalesh about the challenges she faced growing her organization from just a tent with a few volunteers into an internationally recognized nonprofit.
The obvious one is that we work with an incredibly political issue that affects a very vulnerable group of people. And for me, it's something that I've been through. So it's a constant triggering experience to see how refugees are being treated on a daily basis and not being able to change enough of a structural issue where these problems come from to stop what's happening, right? You know, we're not doing that. And like I said, the solution is a political one. It's an end to wars. It's addressing climate change. So that's the most obvious and probably the biggest one. In terms of building an organization, I mean, everything from building a team that is the right team to do what you're doing, to getting the funding that you need, to telling the story of the work that you're doing in a way that people understand, to building an organizational culture that's supportive and safe and recognizes people. All of these things are incredibly difficult things to do. And we've probably stumbled along the way in each of those things. But like I said, the thing that I'm really grateful for is not being afraid of acknowledging and recognizing failure and growing from that and kind of being able to say, okay, this is, you know, we didn't get this one right, or this is how we could change this. And having the agility and flexibility built into the organizational culture, I think has helped us grow as much as we can, or as much as we have. And I think the challenge for us going from where we are is, how do we keep that agility? How do we keep that responsiveness whilst becoming an institution, essentially? And it's a puzzle that I think about all the time, and I haven't got a concrete answer to yet, because you want to have enough of a structure in your organization to support the growing work. But at the same time, you want to be able to respond to things as they come, and you want to be able to change. And that's a tricky thing to balance. Personally, I wish someone had told me that I wasn't going to really have a life for the first 5 years, because I really didn't, you know. And still, it's leading a startup means that is your life, and that's all you do pretty much every day.
Is there anything you'd have done differently now that you're 6 years in and have got through your first 5 years of mayhem and done very well? What are the things that you'd wish you'd known at the beginning?
I wish someone had told me how difficult fundraising is, because I had never done fundraising before AMNA, and it is a really difficult and very network-based. You have to develop relationships and networks with people, and it takes a really long time. So I think that was completely new to me, and I had to learn it on the job, as it were. I definitely wish that I'd had better skills and taken care of myself as I was doing it, because I was so driven by what I saw, you know, in the camps and the places where we worked, and the sort of the fear and desperation that we saw in people, that really gave me a sense of urgency that at times I definitely forgot to stop, to take some time off, to rest, you know, to basically make sure that I was okay. It's really difficult, because when you're working in emergencies and you're working in those kind of circumstances, when you're comparing yourself to the people that you're working for, you always feel more privileged because you do have a passport and you can go and sleep in a hotel room or your apartment. And that feels almost wrong to take time to restore yourself. But actually, if you're going to be able to do this work for a long time, you need to be able to do that. And I definitely, for the first couple of years especially, I really didn't have that boundary with myself. So I just worked all the time and I did as much as I could. And then realized that that was not sustainable and I needed to have some sort of balance. So I think those are probably, personally and for friends, those are the two things that I wish I'd known more about before I started it. And a warning to my family and friends. I think I wish I'd been more like, guys, I'm not going to be around for any birthdays, you know, sort of your life stuff. I'm not going to be around, but I still very much want to be your friend. So I think that would have been really helpful because I've missed a lot of what's happened in my friends and my family's lives.
Wow. Well, I think you've clearly just devoted your whole life and being to this in the last few years. You mentioned fundraising, and I actually think you can't do this the first time you set up an organization, but once you have a fundraising network, you can go and raise more money than, you know, you may have otherwise thought you needed. And you can start by hiring great other people to work with. You know, you're going to be working really hard no matter what happens. But the difference between really hard and burnout is significant in a life. But I do think the first time you set up an organization, there's not much you can do. You know, you're sort of breaking new ground. It's been so wonderful to hear of your story, personal story, many trials and tribulations, but then how you've been able to really pass on so much about what you've learned to others going through the same situation. What do you hope that listeners, people listening today, would take away from this conversation?
Whenever I speak about my own story and about the work that we do, my hope is always to bring in some insight about the refugee experience and hope that we get allies that understand the urgency of protecting the rights of refugees, of supporting them when they arrive. You know, we both live in the UK. So in a place like the UK, the urgency of organizing against the criminalization of asylum rights right now and what's happening to refugees when they arrive. That's my hope always, to connect, you know, one human experience to another human who may have certain privileges, but essentially we're all part of the same community, and to enable that sort of empathy. Because what's happening to refugees does actually affect everybody because it signals the kind of society that we're living in. Are we able to take care of people that are vulnerable and oppressed and find themselves in a difficult situation? Or are we not? And refugees tend to be the people that are first in line when we erode our values, but then that will affect other vulnerable people and other vulnerable communities. It's almost like an indicator of where we're headed. And to me, right now, what's happening, not just in the UK, but around the world, it's very frightening. It's very frightening. And so I hope that more people can ally themselves to the cause of refugees and support them.
We might be struggling to control climate change or the geopolitical forces that result in war, but we can take care of innocent people who suffer the consequences. Zalash's story shows that the path to building an organization can be rocky, but things will ultimately work out if you're truly committed to the cause and open to learning. Thanks so much to our media partner, Alliance Magazine. If you'd like to stay connected with the latest news in global philanthropy, Mission to Scale listeners can get 50% off your first subscription by using the code SPRINGIMPACT at checkout. That's Spring Impact, one word. Visit alliancemagazine.org to find out more. That's it for today's episode. Please don't forget to subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss out on any of our episodes. And while you're there, I'd appreciate it if you could rate and give us a review. If you love Mission to Scale, I hope you recommend our show to a friend or colleague. Thanks so much for joining us, and I'll catch you all in the next episode. Mission to Scale is produced by Spring Impact and Human Group Media. If you want to learn more about our work at Spring Impact, visit springimpact.org and follow us at Spring Impact on Twitter.